Moscow, journalist and political commentator. Thank you. And thank you, Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations from Stockholm. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Here's a look at our headlines. The United States unveils a fresh arms package for Ukraine consisting of precision rocket systems and combat drones. Iran censures the Israeli regime's latest attack on Damascus suburbs for violating Syria's sovereignty. Also ahead, Donald Trump's former aide Steve Bannon is convicted of contempt of Congress for refusing to appear before a committee investigating last year's attack on the U.S. Capitol. Thank you for joining us. The United States keeps pumping military aid into Ukraine. It has signed off an additional $270 million worth of weapons for the country to help it fight Russia. The White House says President Joe Biden has made it clear that Washington will continue to support Ukraine and its people for as long as it takes. More than half of the latest aid comes from a $40 billion package Congress approved for Ukraine in May. The aid includes portable drones and 4 more HIMARS precision rocket systems, among others. That brings to 20 the number of HIMARS systems sent to Ukraine. Officials there have called them a game-changer in countering Russia. Moscow has already warned against sending arms to Ukraine, accusing the West of fueling the flame of war. Ever since the war in Ukraine started, Press TV has been closely following the developments and keeping you up to date with them. Central to that effort has been our correspondent on the ground there, Johnny Miller. Reporting from a war-torn country was always going to present its own challenges and risks. But now Johnny says he's been placed on a kill list of an ultra-nationalist group in Ukraine. This after he reported on a story about a kill list associated with the Ukrainian government promoting violence against pro-Russia children in the Donbass region. A number of journalists have been killed in Ukraine after being put on the list.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Verets, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Olaz Bezina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Riccelli, an Italian journalist, after he is killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mirotervets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism. They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. They basically, that's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. So, like the old saying is that the other's one's terrorist is another other one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Now, Yanis Putkonen. Another reporter on the kill list is with us from the Donbass region. He is a Finnish media director and chief editor at Patriotic News Network. Yanis, thank you so much for joining us. What does it feel like to be on a kill list? Do you fear for your life? Have you received any threats?
No, of course, being threatened for extended period of time, I have been in that kill list since 2015. And over these years of long civil war here in Donbas, where I've been living permanently, the front line is very close to us, you know, 10 just kilometers away from my office is my home. And of course, you just pray every day that the guys will hold the line and the Nazi battalions will not take over the city, because that would mean that if I would be falling to the hand of these Nazi battalions, to being on that list means that your life will be basically over on that moment. So of course, being hunted is not a place where you want to be. And this kind of listing of people to such kind of death threats publicly is against all morale and ethics, what I see in the world community.
Now, what do you think there is such a website? What do you think there is such a list to begin with? And what do you think Western nations like NATO countries are silent when it comes to such a list and extremism, state-sponsored extremism in Ukraine?
Yeah, the problem is that this civil war is a geopolitical civil war, and it's waged far away from the Ukrainian borders. And the officials have very limited, even in Kiev government or any government in the world, has a very limited influence on what's happening here since 2014, because these Nazi battalions, which are funded by the oligarchs, this whole movement of neo-Nazis in Ukraine It's a very globalist mafia element. It's an extremist organization like ISIS or any other terrorist organization, and the governments have very limited possibilities to affect them, and this kill list for these battalions is one of the great examples that how weak the governments and officials and international law and institutions are against this kind of criminal organizations.
I mean, apart from journalists and politicians, there are also some children whose name appear on the list. What do you think children are on that kill list?
You know, I get the goosebumps when you mention this. It's absolutely sorry and terrible. And that is exactly what has happened here in Donbas for, since 2014 and all these years. We haven't had a single day of ceasefire. And killing Donbas people, hundreds and thousands of them, and the world community turning their back to Donbas people has been a just unbelievable crime from the world community not to put any attention for these people here. And that's why I end up here. I came to help. I came to cooperate. I came to do my best so that the world will know that the Donbas children has right to live.
And as a journalist who is on a kill list, what do you expect international organizations to do?
I think in the end, they have to face the reality that what they have created, what is Azov Battalion, what is Aidar, what are these oligarchs who are running these shows here in the frame of and using nations and people for their multinational agendas, and me as a journalist or Fiona as a children, we haven't harmed anybody. I swear to God that over these 7 years here in Donbas, I have not intention to harm anyone, and certainly Fiona doesn't also is willing to harm anyone. So that's why this truth will haunt world community, and I hope that Mirot Boric as a public kill list will teach the world a very big lesson that there are limits where you can go, and if these limits of total war is stepped over, there is no back to humanity, moral and ethics, and we need to get this thing down, and we need to I have been used to it because I've been there already for 7 years, but I know that every person who followed this list, and I have lots of friends in that list, and it makes them wondering everything, you know. It's not fair because there is no truth in that list. It's just a show of aggression, a show of unrespect, and it's a psychological warfare, and it's very cruel for the people of Donbas, Ukraine, Russia, and we need to stop this kind of development.
Sure thing. It's as cruel as it can get. Yanis, thank you so much for joining us. That was Yanis Putkonen, a Finnish media director and chief editor at Patriotic News Network, joining us from the Donbass region. Moving on, Syria has called on the United Nations to condemn Israel's attack on Damascus suburbs on Friday that killed 3 soldiers and injured 7 others. In separate letters to the UN Secretary General and the UN Security Council, the Syrian Foreign Ministry said Damascus reserves the right to respond to Israel's repeated acts of aggression. The ministry added that the UN should take action to prevent Israel's attacks. Iran also strongly denounced the Israeli raids as atrocious and clear violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Tehran also criticized the silence of international bodies, especially the Security Council, in the face of what it called Israel's persistent crimes and dangerous behavior. Investigative journalist Rick Sterling believes Israel continues to attack Syria because the UN takes no action to reprimand the regime.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, they keep getting away with it because nobody takes action. The UN Security Council does little or nothing to reprimand or punish Syria or punish Israel. This is the one report says this is the 17th attack this year by Israel on Syria. That's more than two per month, and they keep doing it. One can just imagine if 10 people were killed and wounded in Israel by an attack from Syria, it would be front page news. I think they have the goal of just continually antagonizing and provoking Syria, and in a way, in attacking them with impunity, and they can destabilize the government.
The UN brokered truce to hold the war in Yemen will expire on the 2nd of August. Yemen's National Salvation Government has now set new demands to accept the extension of the ceasefire with the Saudi-led coalition for another 6 months. Our correspondent, Abdullatif Al-Washili, reports.
As the United Nations is pushing the warring sites in Yemen to renew the truce, the Sana'a government has set new conditions to accept the extension for a third period of 6 months. The head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, said the United Nations is now required to ensure the payment of all salaries which are suspended since 2016.
If the leadership in Sana'a accept the extension of the truce, the commitment under the agreement should be implemented from the first day of the truce. The blockade must be lifted by land, sea and air. All roads must be opened, and the salaries of Yemeni employees must be paid. The oil wells must be preserved, and the suffering of prisoners should be ended. Without this, the truce has no meaning.
Experts say it is likely that Sana'a rejects the terms of the current truce and pushes the United Nations to further ease the suffering of Yemenis by dispersing salaries.
It is clear from the political and military statements of Sana'a that they will not accept the request to extend the ceasefire easily. There are new demands by Sana'a to enter a third period of the agreement. The United Nations must fulfill previous commitments and deal with the new conditions positively. Otherwise, there will be a military escalation.
Yemen's demands come against the backdrop of United Nations' failure to force the Saudi-led coalition to fulfill its commitments under the current agreement that was brokered by the world body in early April.
Disappointing and useless, that's how Yemenis describe the current UN brokered agreement. They say the Yemeni army should be prepared for different scenarios, including military escalation. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The jury has convicted a top advisor to former U.S. President Donald Trump of contempt of Congress. Steve Bannon was found guilty for refusing to appear before a congressional committee investigating the January 6, 2021 storming of the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters. Bannon was subpoenaed by the January 6 committee last September. Now he is facing up to 2 years in jail. The former Trump ally had served as the chief strategist to the then president before being fired in 2017. Trump supporters raided Congress in January 2021 to block the certification of Joe Biden as U.S. president amid allegations of rigged elections. Five people were killed during the unrest.
The anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, which is based in Albania, postpones a summit scheduled for later this month, citing security reasons. The terrorist cult says it has shelved the two-day meeting until further notice upon recommendations by the government. This after the U.S. Embassy warned American citizens against taking part in the event. The meeting was set to be held on July 23rd and 24th in the group's Albanian base called Camp Ashraf 3. The MKO launched a series of bombings and assassinations in Iran, mostly in the 1980s. Iranian authorities hold the group responsible for the death of more than 17,000 people in Iran. But the cult has been enjoying freedom of activity in the West since being delisted by the EU and the US in 2009 and 2012, respectively. Over the past years, dozens of Western politicians, among them former US officials, have taken part in the group's annual meetings in Europe. Over the past months, MKO agents have assaulted many Iranian nationals in several European countries. Last month, a Press TV reporter and her news team were attacked while covering an exhibition in Sweden that displayed the crimes committed by the group. Well, that's your world news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
As infections soar in the third major coronavirus wave this year, British experts say COVID may never settle down into a seasonal cycle. We have prepared for you an article written by Hannah Devlin. The piece is titled, "The Way It's Playing Out is Unexpected. UK Faces Up to Changing Waves of COVID." A startling proportion of the UK population will be cooped up in their bedrooms, having the strange experience of nursing a fever and sore throat in July, as COVID infections continue to soar in the third major wave this year. For most, this will be an unpleasant inconvenience rather than a tragedy. But with a fourth wave expected in the autumn, a fifth potentially kicking off by Christmas, and experts saying that COVID may never settle down into a seasonal cycle, some are questioning whether this steady, grind of illness is sustainable. Seasonal flu has been a benchmark for COVID since the earliest phase of the pandemic, and in the spring, a threshold was crossed, and COVID became less deadly than seasonal flu for all age groups. This was good news, of course. However, the impact of an illness on society also depends on how many people are infected and how often. Many had assumed by this point Britons might be at least heading towards a more regular pattern of infection with COVID, in which they would endure a few tough months during the winter months and forget it for the rest of the year. Instead, the reverse appears to be occurring. Dr. Stephen Kister, an epidemiologist at Harvard University, said, "The way that the pandemic has played out and is continuing to play out is unexpected." Dr. Stephen Kister and colleagues published a highly influential paper in April of 2020 that predicted that seasonal resurgences of COVID could occur as far into the future as 2025. For many in the scientific community, this was a coin drop moment that provided a glimpse of what lay behind the first few months of catastrophe and crisis, and sowed the seed of expectation that COVID would become seasonal. Dr. Stephen Kister said, "We'd expected strong seasonal wintertime patterns where you don't see a lot of outside those winter months. This was because, with limited information to go on at the time, respiratory viruses have a natural advantage in the winter when people are cooped up indoors and where our immune systems are potentially less effective. And for many viruses, once a winter wave has passed, people remain immune for long enough to suppress infection until the following year." Two years on, Dr. Stephen Kister's views have changed. He said, "We're in a different landscape now. The fact we're having such a rapid succession of variants, we seem to be racking them up at alarming speed, is the most surprising thing, and that's changed the way the waves look." He said, "I would have thought it would have reached a steady state by now. It seems the opposite is the case." Others have also been taken by surprise by this pattern. Professor Peter Openshaw, an immunologist at Imperial College London, said, "It does look as if the successive waves are getting closer together. They are actually becoming more frequent, with one piling in on top of the other." Professor Peter Openshaw added, "The change is that in the first year of the pandemic, new waves were driven by the emergence of more transmissible variants, such as Alpha and Delta, which spread infection more easily. Now, successive variants, including the latest BA.2.75 variant, nicknamed Centaurus, are being driven primarily by immune escape, the ability to infect people who have been vaccinated and infected, even fairly recently." The Australian Health Protection Principal Committee advised recently that infections of BA.4 or BA.5 variants could occur as early as 28 days after recovery from a previous COVID-19 infection. He said, "It almost seems as if the rate of replacement of new variants has accelerated," adding, "There is a shift in what's driving evolution." Each COVID wave no longer brings in a shockingly high death toll, but it is still felt across the United Kingdom. In recent days, school attendance in England fell to the lowest level since January, with nearly one in five secondary pupils absent and 8% of teachers off work. Hospitals, already trying to process massive surgery backlogs, are coming under immense strain due to staff absences, with 26,874 NHS staff off work for COVID-related reasons last week. Ambulance services are being pushed to the limit, with a paramedic describing them as on the fringe of collapse in a recent BBC report. And the already substantial numbers affected by long COVID are continuing to grow. Professor Tim Cook, a consultant in anesthesia and intensive care medicine, said, "In many settings, COVID is an inconvenience now rather than a threat to life, but it continues to have a significant impact on our healthcare. Essential infection control measures are an ongoing burden for hospitals, and staff absences are piling pressure on the system even further." Professor Tim Cook said, "It's a fairly fragile ecosystem. You still have the issue of patients presenting later. Because primary healthcare is difficult to assess, a degree of staff exhaustion, it remains a system under a lot of stress. From a healthcare perspective, the pandemic is certainly not over. There is not a single simple solution to curbing the steady tide of infection." Vaccines have been an overwhelming triumph of the pandemic, but those in use have major limitations in managing this phase. They provide crucial protection against severe illness and death, but not against infection. And protection against mild illness wanes very quickly. This creates a zone of rapidly diminishing returns when it comes to boosting the young, healthy population. There's clear recognition that what we've got now is not ideal, said Adam Finn, a professor of paediatrics at the University of Bristol and a member of the UK's Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, which announced recently that everyone aged 50 years and over would be offered a COVID booster shot in the autumn. Professor Adam Finn added, "We've got a tool that is really good at stopping the old folks from dying. We've more or less given up on the idea of mass immunisation to control the spread of infection. Vaccinating everyone every 3 months is just not feasible." He said special cases could be made for vaccinating healthcare workers, for instance, in anticipation of a tough time in January, adding, "Giving them all a vaccine in November would help." British officials claim the situation could improve as the next generation vaccines become available. Major programs are underway to develop variant-proof vaccines or even pan-coronavirus vaccines that would also work against other endemic coronaviruses. And some predict that these vaccines could produce more enduring immunity. There are also efforts to develop a nasal vaccine similar to the flu vaccine given to primary school children that would be more likely to protect against infection and transmission as well as the illness itself. Professor Danny Altman, an immunologist at Imperial College London, is among those calling for governments to pursue these solutions with far greater intensity. He said, "In early 2020, we had a real unity of purpose on vaccines, which went terribly well. After that, we downed tools and lost interest, but it's not job done, it's job unfinished. We're still in the heat of an arms race, and we're in a stage now we need to up our game." There are also the well-known lower-tech approaches to pandemic management. Germany is investing in improved ventilation systems in schools and in public buildings. New Zealand announced recently that it would bring back free face masks and COVID tests amid a growing Omicron wave. And other countries continue to have stricter guidance on mask wearing and self-isolation. However, in Britain, there appears to be little enthusiasm for more active management of COVID.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Beginning of the End. Part 1.
When Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities were targeted in drone attacks, Riyadh could hardly imagine that the consequences of the face-off with Yemen would be so harsh. Saudi Arabia is Yemen's largest neighbor and the largest country in the Arabian Peninsula. Most of the country is comprised of vast deserts, Saudi Arabia owes its significance among Arab and Islamic countries to two holy and religious cities of Mecca and Medina. Islam is the birthplace of Saudi Arabia and was exported to other countries. After the discovery of oil, Saudi Arabia gradually became one of the, or I better say, the biggest oil exporter in the world. Saudi Arabia's significance today is a combination of the historical significance and its economic weight. Saudi Arabia has always been pivotal in the developments in Yemen, but the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Yemen has many complications. When supporters of Gamal Abdel Nasser and Arab nationalists rose up against the ruling of the Zaydis, Saudi Arabia sided with the Zaydis because if Nasser had come to power, it would pose a danger to Arab monarchies. Nasser became Egypt's president after toppling a monarchical rule. He was against Arab and even Iranian monarchs. He had strong socialist tendencies, and at the same time, he would call himself an Arab nationalist. He would fight with Israel and the UK on the one hand, and on the other, he used a different name for the Persian Gulf and claimed that the three Iranian islands belonged to Arabs. After the 9/11 attacks, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had previously toppled the Zaydi rule, got closer to the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Riyadh secretly funded al-Qaeda and got closer to Saleh, so Saleh released many al-Qaeda terrorists in return. But the friendly ties faced a major problem. The problem was initiated somewhere far away. A poor man in Tunisia set himself ablaze in front of a government building. It was the beginning of a revolution that spread to many Arab countries. It was the beginning of a new story for Yemen. The wave of Islamism in the world was set off in 1979 after the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Before that, anti-West activists in the region were either nationalists or socialists and leftists. But after the revolution, inclinations towards Islamic teachings turned into the major inclination and the anti-Western activism among the people of the region. In 1986, a political group named the Houthi Union was formed in this part of Yemen. Scholars like Mohammed Badreddin al-Houthi and Majid Eddin al-Muyayidi taught subjects about Iran's revolution to the group. Yemenis' interest in the revolution stemmed from their passion for Islamic teachings. Traditionally, there were people who had lived with those teachings generation after generation, and they naturally welcomed the teachings in the political and social arena. The Association of Faithful Youth was established in 1992. Badreddin al-Houthi had a role in founding the association along with Mohammed Saleh Azam and Abdul Karim Jaban. In 1997, the Organization of the Faithful Youth splintered off the previous association under the leadership of Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi. Hussein's goal was to return to the ruling by the imams and abstention from giving zakat, that's religious taxes, to the illegal government. In other words, they wanted to establish an Islamic government. In fact, the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of an Islamic government in Iran served as a role model. In Yemen, just like in Lebanon, Bahrain, Palestine, and Afghanistan, some people came up with the idea of establishing an Islamic government. Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi moved towards military training. After the military training in the Organization of the Faithful Youth was raised, more youth welcomed it warmly. Ali Abdullah Saleh's government had a dual approach vis-a-vis the organization. At first, it tolerated the organization and even financially supported the organization's schools and its cultural activities because by the help of the organization, it could stop al-Qaeda and Wahhabi infiltration in Yemen. Wahhabis took advantage of the abject poverty in Yemen and propagated themselves to find supporters. Saudi Arabia also funded them. Ali Abdullah Saleh was worried the changes may threaten his own government as well. But when he found out about their political tendencies and military training, things changed. He closed down the organization's schools and put their leaders under surveillance. But Sayed Hussein Houthi's father, Sayed Bedreddin, who was one of the revered religious marjayas in Yemen, intervened to reopen the schools. The government set a condition that Sayed Hussein has no right to get involved with the schools. Hussein moved to Sada'a. Sada'a is a city near the Saudi border in a mountainous region. It's an old city with typical Yemeni buildings, but now it's the capital of Sada'a province. Houthis are from this province. Hussein al-Houthi moved from Sada'a to a small province named Haydan, 39 kilometers away from the provincial capital Sada'a. Hussein al-Houthi became the prayers leader of the Grand Mosque in the Haydan and started his activities to recruit forces. In the Zaydi sect, only a person who rises up with a sword can become a leader, just like Zayd, Imam Zayn al-Abidin's son, the Zaydis follow. So Hussein proclaimed his leadership. The main motto of his movement was to fight the U.S. Politically, Hussein was a supporter of the Islamic Republic of Iran. What's more, he supported anti-Israeli Islamic groups like Hezbollah and the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement. Sayed Hussein considered Israel as one of the main enemies of Islam. He launched a campaign to ban Israeli and U.S. goods in Yemen. The administration of Ali Abdullah Saleh sensed the danger. An Islamic movement in Yemen, similar to Hezbollah, could be a threat to his long-time rule. Many Houthi youths were arrested on charges of trying to restore the Zaydi government. That was a time when the U.S. faced the 9/11 attacks. If Wahhabism was considered a problem for Muslims and the Islamic world, now, after the September 11th attacks, everyone in the world was saying that Wahhabism is a major problem. U.S. asked many countries to arrest certain individuals known as Wahhabi leaders who were tied to terrorist activities. In Yemen, several names were mentioned who were top political figures. Yemeni tribes would not turn them in. Ali Saleh knew Yemen's tribal structure and decided not to get into a conflict with the structure. So he negotiated with the U.S. ambassador in Yemen and convinced him that the Houthi movement was more dangerous than Al-Qaeda. Al-Isadi's main argument was that the Houthi movement followed Imam Khomeini's thoughts, and it means the Houthis consider the U.S. as their main enemy. Finally, on the sidelines of a G8 summit in 2004, Ali Abdullah Saleh managed to get Washington's approval to crack down on the Houthis. The crackdown started in Sada'a. In September of 2004, Hussein al-Houthi was killed in a Maran district, but his death did not put an end to the war. When the war broke out between followers of the Houthis and the government forces, there were only 200 Houthi fighters. But after Hussein al-Houthi's death, his brother Abdul Malik al-Houthi recruited several hundred thousand people for the organization. Abdul Malik was Hussein's younger brother. He was born in 1979. His ideas were not different from his brother's, fighting with oppressive rulers and providing welfare and education for the poor. After Hussein al-Houthi's death and Abdul Malik's succession, Hussein's father, Badreddin al-Houthi, went to Sana'a for talks with Ali Abdullah Saleh, but he returned empty-handed. The war started again. In the spring of 2005, the second war ended after the victory of the government. In the fall of the same year, the conflict started once again and continued until the spring of the following year. In 2006, while there was a truce agreement between the Houthis and the government, the Houthis demanded that 7 Yemeni Jews be expelled. They said the 7 Jews spread corruption among the youth. In reaction to the request, Ali Abdullah Saleh wrote a letter to Abdul Malik and asked him to hand over their arms and forces. Soon, the fourth war broke out, and in the spring of 2007, the fifth war. The fifth war started after several people close to the government were assassinated, and the government accused the Houthis of those killings. A claim refused by the Houthis, but the war was inevitable. This time around, the war spilled over to other provinces as well. Ali Abdullah realized that the odds were against him. During the 30th anniversary of his presidency on July 17, 2008, he announced that the fifth war was over and promised that no new war will be launched between the government and the Houthis. But his promise did not last long. The following year, on July 10, 2009, Ali Saleh claimed that the Houthis had violated the truce and attacked government-controlled areas. The Saleh government launched a Saudi-backed airstrike on the Houthis. Saleh talked to the heads of the tribes and warned them that the Houthis want to restore the Zaydi movement under the leadership of Abdul Malik. This time, the Houthis were successful. They had Katyushas and cannons and managed to achieve numerous victories. The U.S. and Saudi fighter jets directly entered the war. But the Houthis took shelter in the mountainous areas that were not accessible by the fighter jets. These mountains have served as a hideout for Yemeni fighters against offensive tribes for centuries. Now, the mountains became the shelters for the Yemenis once again. In February 2010, the tribal chiefs intervened to stop the war. Next year, in 2011, Sada'a and the Houthis were no longer the biggest threats to Ali Abdullah Saleh. Ali Saleh was the president of Yemen for decades. He was planning on having his son succeed him. Corruption was widespread across the country and people were poor. It wasn't anything new, but when people got the news that revolutions were taking place in Tunisia and Egypt, Yemenis also took to the streets. This time, Sana'a turned into the resistance bastion against the government.
In the limelight.
U.S. lawmakers added $37 billion beyond what the Pentagon asked for, most of it going to defense contractors, says William Hartung, author, in an article published under the heading, "The U.S. House Military Spending Bill is a massive giveaway to the weapons industry." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The U.S. House of Representatives has recently passed its version of the National Defense Authorization Act, which sets policy goals and recommends a number for total Pentagon spending. The final version of the bill will be determined later this year. The House bill would set spending for the Pentagon and related activities like work on nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy at an astonishing $850 billion, $37 billion more than the Pentagon even asked for in its FY 2023 budget request. The vast bulk of the added funds will go to pad the bottom lines of contractors like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, the General Dynamics. The House doubled down on the latest installment of the Pentagon's three-decades-long $2 trillion nuclear weapons build-up. Of the $37 billion in add-ons to the Pentagon's proposal, over two-thirds, or $25 billion, will go to weapons procurement and research and development, categories of funding that mostly go to contractors. By contrast, the increase for military personnel and health was just $1 billion, an indication that corporate profits continue to come before the needs of the troops.
We'll be right back.
Many of the additions to the Pentagon budget had more to do with parochial politics than they did with any coherent defense strategy. Representative Jared Golden, who co-sponsored the amendment that added the $37 billion when the bill was under consideration by the House Armed Services Committee, made sure to include an extra Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, a $2 billion ship built in Bath, Maine, under the auspices of General Dynamics. Golden's co-sponsor for the add-on was Representative Eileen Loria, whose district abuts the Huntington Ingalls Corporation's Newport News shipbuilding subsidiary, which builds aircraft carriers and attack submarines and will benefit from the $4 billion in added funds for shipbuilding included in the House bill. The bill also added three Lockheed Martin F-35s and eight Boeing F-18s, while preventing the Air Force from retiring 12 Boeing F-15s. One of the most egregious moves by the House was its decision to block the administration from scrapping five of the nine littoral combat ships it had hoped to eliminate. The